Confederate scouts reported a Union flotilla of transport ships and gunboats, lights off, trying to make a run past the batteries at Vicksburg. The cannons roared, but somehow the ships got past them with minimal damage. The next few weeks saw several more runs down the river. At the same time, Union forces on the western side of the river were reported heading south. Now it was clear. Grant would use the transport ships he had sneaked past Vicksburg to cross the Mississippi some 30 miles downriver. Then he would march on the fortress from the south. Pemberton called for reinforcements, but in truth he was not overly concerned. Even if Grant got thousands of men across the river, what could he do once there? If he moved north toward Vicksburg, the Confederacy could send armies from Jackson and point south to take him from the flank and rear. Defeat in this corridor would be a disaster, for Grant would have no line of retreat. He had committed himself to a foolhardy venture. Pemberton waited patiently for his next move. Grant did cross the river south of Vicksburg, and in a few days his army was moving northeast, heading for the rail line from Vicksburg to Jackson. This was his most audacious move so far. If he were successful, he would cut Vicksburg off from its lifeline. But Grant's army, no different from any other, needed lines of communication and supply. These lines would have to connect to a base on the eastern side of the river, which Grant had indeed established at the town of Grand Gulf. All Pemberton had to do was send forces south from Vicksburg to destroy or even just threaten Grand Gulf, endangering Grant's supply lines. He would be forced to retreat south or risk being cut off. It was a game of chess that Pemberton could not lose. And so, as the northern general maneuvered his armies with speed toward the rail line between Jackson and Vicksburg, Pemberton moved on Grand Gulf. To Pemberton's utter dismay, Grant ignored him. Indeed, so far from dealing with the threat to his rear, he pushed straight on to Jackson, taking it on May 14th. Instead of relying on supply lines to feed his army, he plundered the area's rich farmlands. More, he moved so swiftly and changed direction so fluidly that Pemberton could not tell which part of his army was the front, rear, or flank. Rather than struggle to defend lines of communication or supply, Grant kept none. No one had ever seen an army behave in such a manner, breaking every rule in the military playbook. A few days later, with Jackson under his control, Grant wheeled his troops toward Vicksburg. Pemberton rushed his men back from Grand Gulf to block the Union general, but it was too late. Beaten at the Battle of Champion Hill, he was forced back into the fortress, where his army was quickly besieged by the Union forces. On July 4th, Pemberton surrendered Vicksburg, a blow the South would never recover from. Interpretation. We humans are conventional by nature. Once anyone succeeds at something with a specific strategy or method, it is quickly adopted by others and becomes hardened into principle. Often to everyone's detriment when it is applied indiscriminately. This habit is a particular problem in war. For war is such risky business that generals are often tempted to take the road well traveled. When so much is necessarily unsafe, what has proven safe in the past has amplified appeal. And thus for centuries, the rules have been that an army must have lines of communication and supply, and in battle must assume a formation with flanks and a front. Napoleon loosened these principles, but their hold on military thinkers remained so strong that during the American Civil War, some 40 years after Napoleon's death, officers like Pemberton could not imagine an army behaving according to any other plan. It took great courage for Grant to disobey these conventions and cut himself loose from any base, living instead off the rich lands of the Mississippi Basin. It took great courage for him to move his army without forming a front. Even his own generals, including William Tecumseh Sherman, thought he had lost his mind. This strategy was hidden from Pemberton's view because Grant kept up ordinary appearances by establishing a base at Grand Gulf and forming front and rear to march toward the rail line. By the time Pemberton had grasped the extraordinary nature of Grant's free-flowing attack, he had been taken by surprise and the game was over. To our eyes, Grant's strategy might seem obvious, but it was completely outside Pemberton's experience. To follow convention, to give inordinate weight to what has worked in the past, is a natural tendency. We often ignore some simple yet unconventional idea that in every sense would upset our opponents. It is a matter sometimes of cutting ourselves loose from the past and roaming freely. Going without a security blanket is dangerous and uncomfortable, but the power to startle people with the unexpected is more than worth the risk. This is particularly important when we are on the defensive or in a weakened state. Our natural tendency at such times is to be conservative, which only makes it easier for our enemies to anticipate our moves and crush us with their superior strength. We play into their hands. It is when the tide is against us that we must forget the books, the precedents, the conventional wisdom, and risk everything on the untried and unexpected. 4. The Ojibwe tribe of the North American Plains contained a warrior society known as the Windigokan, no-flight contraries. Only the bravest men who had demonstrated bravery by their utter disregard for danger on the battlefield were admitted to the Windigokan. In fact, because they had no fear of death, they were considered no longer among the living. They slept and ate separately and were not held to the usual codes of behavior. As creatures who were alive, but among the dead, they spoke and acted contrarily. They called a young person an old man, and when one of them told the others to stand still, he meant charge forward. They were glum in times of prosperity, happy in the depths of winter. Although there was a clownish side to their behavior, the Windigokan could inspire great fear. No one ever knew what they would do next. The Windigokan were believed to be inhabited by terrifying spirits called thunderers, which appeared in the form of giant birds. That made them somehow inhuman. On the battlefield, they were disruptive and unpredictable, and in raiding parties downright terrifying. In one such raid, witnessed by an outsider, they gathered first in front of the Ojibwe chief's lodge and yelled, "We are not going to war. We shall not kill the Sioux. We shall not scalp four of them and let the rest escape. We shall go in daytime." They left camp that night, wearing costumes of rags and scraps, their bodies plastered with mud and painted with splotches of weird color, their faces covered by frightening masks with giant, beak-like noses. They made their way through the darkness, stumbling over themselves. It was hard to see through the masks, until they came upon a large Sioux war party. Although outnumbered, they did not flee, but danced into the enemy's center. The grotesqueness of their dance made them seem to be possessed by demons. Some of the Sioux backed away. Others drew close, curious and confused. The leader of the Windigokan shouted, "Don't shoot!" The Ojibwe warriors then pulled out guns hidden under their rags, killed four Sioux, and scalped them. Then they danced away, the enemy too terrified by this apparition to pursue them. After such an action, the mere appearance of the Windigokan was enough for the enemy to give them a wide berth and not risk any kind of encounter. Interpretation. What made the Windigokan so frightening was the fact that, like the forces of nature from which they claimed to derive their powers, they could be destructive for no apparent reason. Their mounting of a raid was not governed by need or ordered by the chief. Their appearance bore no relation to anything known, as if they had rolled on the ground or in trays of paint. They might wander in the dark until they chanced on an enemy. Their dancing was like nothing anyone had seen or imagined. They might suddenly start to kill and scalp, then stop at an arbitrary number. In a tribal society governed by the strictest of codes, these were spirits of random destruction and irrationality. The use of the unconventional can startle and give you an advantage, but it does not often create a sense of terror. What will bring you ultimate power in this strategy is to follow the Windigokan and adapt a kind of randomness that goes beyond rational processes. as if you were possessed by a spirit of nature. Do this all the time and you'll be locked up, but do it right, dropping hints of the irrational and random at the opportune moment, and those around you will always have to wonder what you'll do next. You will inspire a respect and fear that will give you great power. An ordinary appearance, spiced by a touch of divine madness, is more shocking and alarming than an out-and-out crazy person. Remember, your madness, like Hamlet's, must be strategic. Real madness is all too predictable. 5. In April 1917, New York's Society of Independent Artists prepared for its first exhibition. This was to be a grand showcase of modern art, the largest in the United States to date. The exhibition was open to any artist who would join the society, whose dues were minimal, and the response had been overwhelming, with over 1,200 artists contributing over 2,000 pieces. The society's board of directors included collectors like Walter Ahrensberg, and artists like Man Ray and the 29-year-old Marcel Duchamp, a Frenchman then living in New York. It was Duchamp, as head of the hanging committee, who decided to make the exhibition radically democratic. He hung the works in alphabetical order, beginning with a letter drawn from a hat. The system led to cubist still lifes being hung next to traditional landscapes, amateur photographs, and the occasional lewd work by someone apparently insane. Some of the organizers loved this plan, others were disgusted and quit. A few days after the exhibition was to open, the society received the strangest work so far, a urinal mounted on its back with the words R. Mutt, 1917, painted in large black letters on its rim. The work was called Fountain, and it was apparently submitted by a Mr. Mutt, along with the requisite membership fee. In viewing the piece for the first time, the painter George Bellows, a member of the Society's board, claimed it was indecent and that the Society could not exhibit it. Ahrensberg disagreed. He said he could discern an interesting work of art in its shape and presentation. "This is what the whole exhibit is about," he told Bellows, "an opportunity to allow the artist to send in anything he chooses, for the artist to decide what is art, not someone else." Bellows was unmoved. Hours before the exhibition opened, the board met and voted by a slim margin not to show the piece. Ahrensberg and Duchamp immediately resigned. In newspaper articles reporting this controversy, the object was politely referred to as a bathroom fixture. It piqued a lot of curiosity, and an air of mystery pervaded the entire affair. At the time of the exhibition, Duchamp was one of a group of artists who published a magazine called The Blind Man. The magazine's second issue included a photograph of Fountain, taken by the great photographer Alfred Stieglitz, who lit the urinal beautifully so that a shadow fell over it like a kind of veil, giving it a slightly religious appearance, along with something vaguely sexual in the arguably vaginal shape of the urinal when laid on its back. The Blind Man also ran an editorial, The Richard Mutt Case, that defended the work and criticized its exclusion from the show. "Mr. Mutt's fountain is not immoral, no more than a bathtub is immoral. Whether Mr. Mutt with his own hands made the fountain or not has no importance. He chose it. He took an ordinary article of life, placed it so that its useful significance disappeared under the new title and point of view. Created a new thought for that object." It soon became clear that the creator of Fountain was none other than Duchamp. And over the years, the work began to assume a life of its own, even though it mysteriously disappeared from Stieglitz's studio and was never found again. For some reason, the photograph and the story of Fountain inspired endless ideas about art and art-making. The work itself had strange powers to shock and compel. In 1953, the Sidney Janis Gallery, New York, was authorized by Duchamp to exhibit a replica of Fountain over its entrance door, a sprig of mistletoe emerging from the bowl. Soon, more replicas were appearing in galleries, retrospective exhibitions of Duchamp's work, and museum collections. fountain became a fetish object, something to collect. Replicas of it have sold for over $1 million. Everyone seems to see what they want to see in the piece. Shown in museums, it often still outrages the public, some disturbed by the urinal itself, others by its presentation as art. Critics have written extended articles on the urinal with all kinds of interpretations. In staging Fountain, Duchamp was urinating on the art world. He was playing with notions of gender. The piece is an elaborate verbal pun, on and on. What some of the organizers of the 1917 show believed to be merely an indecent object unworthy of being considered art has somehow turned into one of the most controversial, scandalous, and analyzed works of the 20th century. Interpretation. Throughout the 20th century, many artists wielded influence by being unconventional. The Dadaists, the Surrealists, Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, the list is long. But of all of them, it is Marcel Duchamp who has probably had the greatest impact on modern art, and what he calls his ready-mades are perhaps the most influential of all his works. The ready-mades are everyday objects, sometimes exactly as they were made, a snow shovel, a bottle rack, sometimes slightly altered, the urinal laid on its back, the mustache and goatee drawn on a reproduction of the Mona Lisa. Chosen by the artist, and then placed in a gallery or museum. Duchamp was giving the ideas of art priority over its images. His ready-mades, banal and uninteresting in themselves, inspired all kinds of associations, questions, and interpretations. A urinal may be a seedy commonplace, but to present it as art was utterly unconventional and stirred up angry, irritating, delirious ideas. Understand. In war, politics, and culture, what is unconventional, whether it is Hannibal's elephants and oxen or Duchamp's urinal, is never material. Or rather, it is never just material. The unconventional can only arise out of the mind. Something surprises is not what we expected. We usually base our expectations on familiar conventions, clichés, habits of seeing, the ordinary. Many artists, writers, and other producers of culture seem to believe at the height of unconventionality to create images, texts, and other works that are merely weird, startling, or shocking in some way. These works may generate a momentary splash, but they have none of the power of the unconventional and extraordinary because they have no context to rub against. They do not work against our expectations. No more than strange, they quickly fade from memory. When striving to create the extraordinary, always remember, what is crucial is the mental process, not the image or maneuver itself. What will truly shock and linger long in the mind are those works and ideas that grow out of the soil of the ordinary and banal, that are unexpected, that make us question and contest the very nature of the reality we see around us. Most definitely in art, the unconventional can only be strategic. Reversal. There is never any value in attacking opponents from a direction or in a way that they expect, allowing them to stiffen their resistance. That is, unless your strategy is suicide. Here are further reflections on the ordinary-extraordinary strategy. By Frederick the Great. Everything which the enemy least expects will succeed the best. If he relies for security on a chain of mountains that he believes impracticable, and you pass these mountains by roads unknown to him, he is confused to start with. And if you press him, he will not have time to recover from his consternation. In the same way, if he places himself behind a river to defend the crossing, and you find some ford above or below on which to cross unknown to him, this surprise will derange and confuse him. From The Wiles of War, 36 military strategies from ancient China. Make a false move, not to pass it for a genuine one, but to transform it into a genuine one after the enemy has been convinced of its falsity. From The Generalship of Alexander the Great by J.F.C. Fuller. It is assumed that Alexander encamped at Haranpur. Opposite him on the eastern back of the Hydaspes was Porus, who was seen to have with him a large number of elephants. Because all fords were held by pickets and elephants, Alexander realized that his horses could neither be swum nor rafted across the river, because they would not face the trumpeting of the elephants and would become frantic when in the water or on their rafts. He resorted to a series of feints. While small parties were dispatched to reconnoiter all possible crossing places, he divided his army into columns, which he marched up and down the river as if he sought a place of crossing. Then, when shortly before the summer solstice the rains set in and the river became swollen, he had corn conveyed from all quarters to his camp, so that Porus might believe that he had resolved to remain where he was until the dry weather. In the meantime, he reconnoitered the river with his ships, and ordered tent skins to be stuffed with hay and converted into rafts. Yet, as Arrian writes, all the time he was waiting in ambush to see whether by rapidity of movement he could not steal a passage anywhere without being observed. At length, and we may be certain after a close personal reconnaissance, Alexander resolved to make the attempt at the headland and island described by Arrian, and in preparation he decided on a maneuver almost identical with that adopted by General Wolfe in his 1759 Quebec campaign. Under cover of night, he sent out his cavalry to various points along the western bank of the river with orders to make a clamor, and from time to time to raise the battle cry. For several nights Porus marched his elephants up and down the eastern bank to block an attempted crossing until he got tired of it, kept his elephants in camp, and posted scouts along the eastern bank. Then, when Alexander had brought it about that the mind of Porus no longer entertained any fear of his nocturnal attempts, he devised the following stratagem. Upstream and along the western bank, he posted a chain of sentries, each post in sight and hearing of the next one, with orders to raise a din and keep their picket fires burning while visible preparations were made at the camp to effect a crossing. When Porus had been lulled into a sense of false security and all preparations were completed at the camp and the crossing place, Alexander set out secretly and kept at some distance from the western bank of the river so that his march would not be observed. From The Wiles of War, 36 Military Strategies from Ancient China. To cross the sea without heaven's knowledge, one had to move openly over the sea but act as if one did not intend to cross it. Each military maneuver has two aspects, the superficial move and the underlying purpose. By concealing both, one can take the enemy completely by surprise. If it is highly unlikely that the enemy can be kept ignorant of one's actions, one can sometimes play tricks right under its nose. From the I Ching. Chaos, where brilliant dreams are born. By Su Dong. One who studies ancient tactics and employs the army in accord with their methods is no different than someone who glues up the tuning stops and yet tries to play a zither. I have never heard of anyone being successful. The acumen of strategists lies in penetrating the subtle amid unfolding change and discerning the concordant and contrary. Now, whenever mobilizing, you must first employ spies to investigate whether the enemy's commanding general is talented or not. If instead of implementing tactics, he merely relies on courage to employ the army, you can resort to ancient methods to conquer him. However, if the commanding general excels in employing ancient tactics, you should use tactics that contradict the ancient methods to defeat him. From The Theory of the Avant-Garde by Renato Poggioli. The chief characteristic of fashion is to impose and suddenly to accept as new rule or norm what was, until a minute before, an exception or whim, then to abandon it again after it has become a commonplace, everybody's thing. Fashion's task, in brief, is to maintain a continual process of standardization, putting a rarity or novelty into general and universal use, then passing on to another rarity or novelty when the first has ceased to be such. Only modern art, because it expresses the avant-garde as its own extreme or supreme moment, or simply because it is the child of the romantic aesthetic of originality and novelty, can consider as the typical, and perhaps sole, form of the ugly what we might call ci-devant beauty, the beauty of the ancien regime, ex-beauty. Classical art, through the method of imitation and the practice of repetition, tends toward the ideal of renewing in the sense of integration and perfection. But for the modern art in general, and for avant-garde in particular, the only irremediable and absolute aesthetic error is a traditional artistic creation, an art that imitates and repeats itself. From the anxious modern longing for what Rémy de Gourmont chose to call, suggestively, le beau inédit, derives that sleepless and fevered experimentation, which is one of the most characteristic manifestations of the avant-garde. Its assiduous labor is an eternal web of Penelope, with the weave of its forms remade every day and unmade every night. Perhaps Ezra Pound intended to suggest both the necessity and the difficulty of such an undertaking, when he once defined the beauty of art as a brief gasp between one cliché and another. The connection between the avant-garde and fashion is therefore evident. Fashion, too, is a Penelope's web. Fashion, too, passes through the phase of novelty and strangeness, surprise and scandal, before abandoning the new forms when they become cliché, kitsch, stereotype. Hence the profound truth of Baudelaire's paradox, which gives to genius the task of creating stereotypes. And from that follows, by the principle of contradiction inherent in the obsessive cult of genius in modern culture, that the avant-garde is condemned to conquer, through the influence of fashion, that very popularity it once disdained. And this is the beginning of its end. In fact, this is the inevitable, inexorable destiny of each movement, to rise up against the newly outstripped fashion of an old avant-garde, and to die when a new fashion, movement, or avant-garde appears. By Marcel Duchamp. I have forced myself to contradict myself in order to avoid conforming to my own taste. And lastly, from Warriors, Warfare and the Native American Indian, by Norman Bancroft Hunt. A similar vision among the Siouan tribes turns the warrior into a Heoka, who also exhibits the clown-like behavior of the Wendigokan, the use of sacking as a war shirt and plastering the body with mud. Psychologically, the Heoka was of immense importance, as were similar characters among numerous other tribes. During periods of happiness and plenty, he saw only gloom and despair, and could be goaded into providing hours of harmless amusement when he gorged himself on buffalo ribs while complaining there was no food in the camp, or declared he was dirty and proceeded to wash in a bath of mud. Yet, behind this benign face of the Heoka, there lurked the ever-present fear that he was possessed by the spirit of Iktomi, and was therefore unpredictable and potentially dangerous. He, after all, was the only person who dared challenge the supernaturals, even if he was in dread of a common camp dog, and would run screaming in fright if one approached too close. Thus he made a mockery of the pretensions of some of the warriors, but at the same time emphasized the fact that the powers which guided and protected them in battle were of such strength that only a Heoka might oppose them. Chapter 25. Occupy the Moral High Ground. The Righteous Strategy. In a political world, the cause you are fighting for must seem more just than the enemy's. Think of this as moral terrain that you and the other side are fighting over. By questioning your enemy's motives and making them appear evil, you can narrow their base of support and room to maneuver. Aim at the soft spots in their public image, exposing any hypocrisies on their part. Never assume that the justice of your cause is self-evident. Publicize and promote it. When you yourself come under moral attack from a clever enemy, do not whine or get angry. Fight fire with fire. If possible, position yourself as the underdog, the victim, the martyr. Learn to inflict guilt as a moral weapon. The Moral Offensive. In 1513, the 37-year-old Giovanni de' Medici, son of the illustrious Florentine Lorenzo de' Medici, was elected pope and assumed the name Leo X. The church that Leo now led was in many ways the dominant political and economic power in Europe, and Leo, a lover of poetry, theater, and painting, like others in his famous family, wanted to make it also a great patron of the arts. Earlier popes had begun the building of the Basilica of St. Peter's in Rome, the preeminent seat of the Catholic Church, but had left the structure unfinished. Leo wanted to complete this mighty project, permanently associating it with his name, but he would need to raise a fair amount of capital to be able to pay for the best artists to work on it. And so in 1517, Leo launched a campaign to sell indulgences. Then, as now, it was Catholic practice for the faithful to confess their sins to their priest, who would enforce their contrition by assigning them a penance, a kind of worldly punishment. Today, this might simply be a prayer or a counting of the rosary. But penances were once more severe, including fasts and pilgrimages, or financial payments, known as indulgences. The nobility might pay an indulgence in the form of a saintly relic purchased for their church, a large expense that would translate into the promise of a reduced time spent in purgatory after death, purgatory being a kind of halfway house for those not evil enough for hell, not good enough for heaven, so forced to wait. The lower classes might pay a smaller fee to buy forgiveness for their sins. Indulgences were a major source of church income. For this particular campaign, Leo unleashed a squadron of expert indulgence salesmen across Europe, and the money began to pour in. As his chief architect for the completion of St. Peter's, he appointed the great artist Raphael, who planned to make the building a splendid work of art, Leo's lasting legacy to the world. All was going well until in October 1517, news reached the Pope that a priest named Martin Luther, some tiresome German theologian, had tacked to the doors of the castle church in Wittenberg a tract called the 95 Theses. Like many important documents of the time, the tract was originally in Latin, but it had been translated into German, printed up, and passed out among the public, and within a few weeks all Germany seemed to have read it. The 95 Theses was essentially an attack on the practice of selling indulgences. It was up to God, not the church, to forgive sinners, Luther reasoned, and such forgiveness could not be bought. The tract went on to say that the ultimate authority was Scripture. If the Pope could cite Scripture to refute Luther's arguments, the priest would gladly recant them. The Pope did not read Luther's writings. He preferred poetry to theological discussions. And a single German priest surely posed no threat to the use of indulgences to fund worthy projects, let alone to the church itself. But Luther seemed to be challenging the church's authority in a broad sense, and Leo knew that an unchecked heresy could become the center of a sect. Within recent centuries in Europe, the church had had to put down such dissident sects by the use of force. Better to silence Luther before it was too late. Leo began relatively gently, asking the respected Catholic theologian Sylvester Mazzolini, usually known as Prierius, to write an official response to Luther that he hoped would frighten the priest into submission. Prierius proclaimed that the Pope was the highest authority in the Church, even higher than Scripture. In fact, that the Pope was infallible. He quoted various theological texts written over the centuries in support of this claim. He also attacked Luther personally, calling him a bastard and questioning his motives. Perhaps the German priest was angling for a bishopric? Prierius concluded with the words, "Whoever says that the Church of Rome may not do what it is actually doing in the manner of indulgences is a heretic." The warning was clear enough. Leo had much on his mind during these years, including turmoil in the Ottoman Empire and a plan to launch a new crusade. But Luther's response to Prierius got his attention right away. Luther wrote a text in which he mercilessly took apart Prierius's writings. The Church, he argued, had failed to answer his charges and to base its arguments on Scripture. Unless its authority in granting indulgences and excommunicating heretics was rooted in the Bible, it was not spiritual in nature, but worldly, political, and that kind of authority could and should be challenged. Luther published his text alongside Prierius, allowing readers to compare the two and come to their own conclusions. His direct quotation of Prierius, his audacious and mocking tone, and his use of recently developed printing technology to spread his message far and wide, all this was quite shocking and new to church officials. They were dealing with a clever and dangerous man. It was now clear to Leo that the war between the church and Luther was a war to the death. As the Pope pondered how to get the German priest to Rome and try him as a heretic, Luther accelerated his campaign, continuing to publish at an alarming rate, his tone even more vitriolic. In an open letter to the Christian nobility of the German nation, he claimed that Rome had used its spurious authority to bully and cow the German people for centuries, turning Germany's kingdoms into vassal states. The Church, he said again, was a political power, not a spiritual one, and to prop up its worldly rule, it had resorted to lies, forged documents, whatever means necessary. In On the Babylonian Captivity of the Church, he railed against the Pope's lavish lifestyle, the whoring among the church hierarchy, the blasphemous art Leo funded. The Pope had gone so far as to have staged an immoral and bawdy play by Machiavelli called Mandragora within the Vatican itself. Luther juxtaposed the righteous behavior advocated by the Church with the way its cardinals actually lived. It was the Pope and his entourage, Luther charged, who were the real heretics, not he. In fact, the Pope was the Antichrist. It seemed to Leo that Luther had responded to Prierius's threat by raising the temperature. Clearly, the threat had been weak. The Pope had been too lenient. It was time to show real force and end this war. So Leo wrote a papal bull threatening Luther with excommunication. He also sent church officials to Germany to negotiate the priest's arrest and imprisonment. These officials, however, came back with shocking news that altered everything. In the few short years since the publication of the 95 Theses, Martin Luther, an unknown German priest, had somehow become a sensation, a celebrity, a beloved figure throughout the country. Everywhere the Pope's officials went, they were heckled, even threatened with stoning. Shop windows in almost every German town contained paintings of Luther with a halo over his head. 9/10 of the Germans shout, "Long live Luther," one official reported to Leo, and the other 10th, "Death to Rome." Luther had somehow aroused the German public's latent resentment and hatred of the Church, and his reputation was impeccable. He was a best-selling author, yet he refused the income from his writings, clearly practicing what he preached. The more the Church attacked him, the more popular Luther became. To make a martyr of him now could spark a revolution. Nevertheless, in 1521, Leo ordered Luther to appear in the town of Worms before the Imperial Diet, a gathering of German princes, nobles, and clergy, organized by the newly elected Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. Leo hoped to get the Germans to do his dirty work, and Charles was amenable. A political creature, worried by the anti-authoritarian sentiments that Luther had sparked, he wanted the dispute over. At the Diet, he demanded that the priest recant his teachings. But Luther, as usual, refused, and in dramatic fashion, uttered the memorable line, "Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me." The emperor had no choice. He condemned Luther as a heretic and ordered him to return to Wittenberg to await his fate. On the way home, however, Luther was kidnapped and taken to Warburg Castle. The kidnapping had actually been planned and executed by his many supporters among the aristocracy. He was safe. Living in the castle under an assumed name, he was able to ride out the storm. Leo died that year, and within months of his death, Luther's ideas and the reforms that he had advocated had spread throughout Germany like wildfire. By 1526, a Protestant party was officially recognized in different parts of Europe. This was the birth of the Reformation, and with it the vast worldly power of the Catholic Church, at least as Leo had inherited it, was irrevocably broken. That obscure, pedantic Wittenberg priest had somehow won the war. Interpretation. Luther's original intention in his 95 Theses was to discuss a point of theology, the relationship, or lack of it, between God's forgiveness and papal indulgences. But when he read Prierius's response to his argument, something changed in him. The Pope and his men had failed to find justification for indulgences in the Bible. There was much more they could not justify as well, such as the Pope's unlimited power to excommunicate. Luther came to believe that the Church needed drastic reform. Reformation, however, would require political power. If Luther simply railed at the Church's wickedness from the pulpit or among his fellow priests, he would get nowhere. The Pope and his men had attacked him personally, questioning his motives. Now Luther, in turn, would go on the offensive, fighting fire with fire. Luther's strategy was to make the war public, transforming his moral cause into a political one. He did this by exploiting the previous century's advances in printing technology. His tracts, written in vigorous, angry language that appealed to the masses, were widely disseminated. He chose points of attack that would particularly outrage the German people. The Pope's decadent lifestyle, funded through the sale of indulgences. The use of church power to meddle in German politics. On and on. Perhaps most devastating of all, Luther exposed the church's hypocrisies. Through these various tactics, he was able to spark and stoke a moral anger that spread like fire, forever tainting the public's vision not just of the Pope, but of the Church itself. Luther knew that Leo would respond to him not with arguments based on the Bible, but with heavy-handed force, which he also knew would only make his cause shine all the brighter. And so with incendiary language and arguments that questioned Leo's authority, he baited the Pope into rash counterattacks. Luther already led an exemplary life, but he took it further by refusing all income from his writings. This widely known move, in effect, made his goodness theatrical, a matter for public consumption. In a few short years, Luther gained so much support among the masses that the Pope could not fight him without provoking a revolution. By using morality so consciously and publicly, he transformed it into a strategy for winning power. The Reformation was one of the greatest political victories in history. Understand, you cannot win wars without public and political support, but people will balk at joining your side or cause unless it seems righteous and just. And as Luther realized, presenting your cause as just takes strategy and showmanship. First, it is wise to pick a fight with an enemy that you can portray as authoritarian, hypocritical, and power-hungry. Using all available media, you strike first with a moral offensive against the opponent's points of vulnerability. You make your language strong and appealing to the masses, and craft it, if you can, to give people the opportunity to express a hostility they already feel. You quote your enemy's own words back at them to make your attacks seem fair, almost disinterested. You create a moral taint that sticks to them like glue. Baiting them into a heavy-handed counterattack will win you even more public support. Instead of trumpeting your own goodness, which would make you seem smug and arrogant, you show it through the contrast between their unreasonable actions and your own crusading deeds. Aim at them the most withering charge of all, that they are after power, while you are motivated by something higher and selfless. Do not worry about the manipulations you will have to resort to if you are to win this moral battle. Making a public show that your cause is more just than the enemy's will amply distract people from the means you employ. By Carl Schmitt. There always are concrete human groupings which fight other concrete human groupings in the name of justice, humanity, order, or peace. When being reproached for immorality and cynicism, the spectator of political phenomena can always recognize in such reproaches a political weapon used in actual combat. Keys to Warfare. In almost all cultures, morality, the definition of good and evil, originated as a way to differentiate one class of people from another. In ancient Greece, for example, the word for good was first associated with the nobility, the higher classes who served the state and proved their bravery on the battlefield. The bad, the base, self-centered, and cowardly, were generally the lower classes. Over time, a system of ethics evolved that served a similar but more sophisticated function, to keep society orderly by separating the antisocial and evil from the social and good. Societies use ideas about what is and is not moral to create values that serve them well. When these values fall behind the times or otherwise cease to fit, morality slowly shifts and evolves. There are individuals and groups, however, who use morality for a much different purpose, not to maintain social order, but to extract an advantage in a competitive situation, such as war, politics, or business. In their hands, morality becomes a weapon they yield to attract attention to their cause while distracting attention from the nastier, less noble actions inevitable in any power struggle. They tend to play on the ambivalence we all have about conflict and power, exploiting our feelings of guilt for their purposes. For instance, they may position themselves as victims of injustice so that opposing them seems wicked or insensitive. Or they may make such a show of moral superiority that we feel ashamed to disagree with them. They are masters at occupying the high ground and translating it into some kind of power or advantage. Let us call these strategists moral warriors. There are generally two types, unconscious and conscious. Unconscious moral warriors tend to be motivated by feelings of weakness. They may not be so good at the straightforward game of power, so they function by making other people feel guilty and morally inferior. An unconscious, reflexive way of leveling the playing field. Despite their apparent fragility, they are dangerous on an individual level because they seem so sincere and can have great power over people's emotions. Conscious moral warriors are those who use the strategy knowingly. They are most dangerous on a public level, where they can take the high ground by manipulating the media. Luther was a conscious moral warrior, but being also a genuine believer in the morality he preached, he used the strategy only to help him in his struggle with the Pope. Slipperier moral warriors tend to use it indiscriminately, adapting it to whatever cause they decide to take on. The way to combat moral warriors in general is indicated by certain strategies that have evolved in modern warfare itself. The French officer and writer André Beaufre has analyzed the use of morality as a military strategy in the context of the French-Algerian wars of the 1950s and of the Vietnam wars fought by first France and then the United States. Both the Algerians and the North Vietnamese worked hard to frame each of their respective conflicts as a war of liberation fought by a nation struggling for its freedom against an imperialistic power. Once this view was diffused in the media and accepted by many in the French and American publics, the insurgents were able to court international support, which in turn served to isolate France and the United States in the world community. Appealing directly to groups within these countries that were latently or overtly sympathetic to, or at least ambivalent about their cause, they were able to sap support for the war from within. At the same time, they cleverly disguised the many nasty maneuvers to which they themselves resorted to fight their guerrilla wars. As a result, in the eyes of the world, they dominated the moral battlefield, enormously inhibiting France's and America's freedom of action. Stepping gingerly through a political and moral minefield, these powers could not fight their wars in a winnable manner. Beaufre calls the strategic use of morality an exterior maneuver, for it lies outside the territory being fought over and outside battlefield strategy. It takes place in its own space, its own moral terrain. For Beaufre, both France and the United States made the mistake of ceding the high ground to the enemy. Because both countries had rich democratic traditions and saw their wars as justified, they assumed that others would perceive these struggles the same way. They saw no need to fight for the moral terrain, and that was a fatal mistake. Nations today must play the public game, deflecting their enemies' attempts to portray them as evil. Without appearing to whine about what the other side is doing, they must also work to expose their enemies' hypocrisies, taking the war to the moral court themselves, fighting on apparently moral terms. Cede the moral terrain to the other side, and you limit your freedom of action. Now anything you might have to do that is manipulative yet necessary will feed the unjust image the enemy has publicized, and you will hesitate to take such action. This has great relevance to all forms of conflict. When your enemies try to present themselves as more justified than you are, and therefore more moral, you must see this move for what it most often is. Not a reflection of morality, of right and wrong, but a clever strategy, an exterior maneuver. You can recognize an exterior maneuver in a number of ways. First, the moral attack often comes out of left field, having nothing to do with what you imagine the conflict is about. Something you have done in a completely different arena is dredged up as a way to drain your support or inject you with guilt. Second, the attack is often ad hominem. Rational argument is met with the emotional and personal. Your character, rather than the issue you are fighting over, becomes the ground of the debate. Your motives are questioned and given the darkest turn. Once you realize you are under attack by a moral warrior using the exterior maneuver, it is vital to keep control of your emotions. If you complain or lash out angrily, you just look defensive, as if you had something to hide. The moral warrior is being strategic. The only effective response is to be strategic, too. Even if you know that your cause is just, you can never assume that the public sees it the same way. Appearances and reputation rule in today's world. Letting the enemy frame these things to its liking is akin to letting it take the most favorable position on the battlefield. Once the fight for moral terrain has begun, you must fight to occupy the high ground in the same way you would in a shooting war. Like any form of warfare, moral conflict has both offensive and defensive possibilities. When you are on the offense, you are actively working to destroy the enemy's reputation. Before and during the American Revolution, the great propagandist Samuel Adams took aim at England's reputation for being fair-minded, liberal, and civilized. He poked holes in this moral image by publicizing England's exploitation of the colony's resources and simultaneous exclusion of their people from democratic processes. The colonists had had a high opinion of the English, but not after Adams's relentless campaign. To succeed, Adams had to resort to exaggeration, picking out and emphasizing the cases in which the English were heavy-handed. His was not a balanced picture. He ignored the ways in which the English had treated the colonies rather well. His goal was not to be fair, but to spark a war, and he knew that the colonists would not fight unless they saw the war as just and the British as evil. In working to spoil your enemy's moral reputation, do not be subtle. Make your language and distinctions of good and evil as strong as possible. Speak in terms of black and white. It is hard to get people to fight for a gray area. Revealing your opponent's hypocrisies is perhaps the most lethal offensive weapon in the moral arsenal. People naturally hate hypocrites. This will work, however, only if the hypocrisy runs deep. It has to show up in their values. Few will care about some innocuous, self-contradictory comment made or vote taken long ago. But enemies who trumpet certain values as inherent to their side, yet who do not always adhere to those values in reality, make juicy targets. The Algerian and North Vietnamese propaganda campaigns were so destructive in part because of the discrepancy they were able to show between the values of freedom and liberty espoused by France and the United States, and the actions those countries were taking to squash national independence movements. Both nations seemed hypocritical. If a fight with your enemies is inevitable, always work to make them start it. In 1861, President Abraham Lincoln maneuvered carefully to make the South shoot first at Fort Sumter, initiating the Civil War. That put Lincoln on the moral high ground and won over many ambivalent Northerners to his side. Similarly, even if you are fighting a war of aggression, your goal to take from your enemy, find a way to present yourself not as a conqueror, but as a liberator. You are fighting not for land or money, but to free people suffering under an oppressive regime. In general, in a conflict that is potentially nasty, in which you are certain the enemy will resort to almost anything, it is best that you go on the offensive with your moral campaign and not wait for their attacks. Poking holes in the other side's reputation is easier than defending your own. The more you stay on the offensive, the more you can distract the public from your own deficiencies and faults. And faults are inevitable in war. If you are physically and militarily weaker than your enemy, all the more reason to mount an exterior maneuver. Move the battle to the moral terrain, where you can hamstring and beat a stronger foe. The best defense against moral warriors is to give them no target. Live up to your good name. Practice what you preach, at least in public. Ally yourself with the most just causes of the day. Make your opponents work so hard to undermine your reputation that they seem desperate, and their attacks blow up in their faces. If you have to do something nasty and not in harmony with your stated position or public image, use a cat's paw, some agent to act for you and hide your role in the action. If that is not possible, think ahead and plan a moral self-defense. At all costs, avoid actions that carry the taint of hypocrisy. A stain on your moral reputation can spread like an infection. As you scramble to repair the damage, you often inadvertently publicize the doubts it has opened up, which simply make things worse. So be prudent. The best defense against a moral attack is to have inoculated yourself against it beforehand, by recognizing where you may be vulnerable and taking preventative measures. When Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon and initiated the civil war against Pompey, he was highly vulnerable to the charge of trying to usurp the authority of the Roman Senate in order to become a dictator. He inoculated himself against these charges by acting mercifully toward his enemies in Rome, making important reforms, and going to the extreme in showing his respect for the Republic. By embracing some of the principles of his enemies, he kept their attempts at moral infection from spreading. Wars are most often fought out of self-interest. A nation goes to war to protect itself against an invading or potentially dangerous enemy, or to seize a neighbor's land or resources. Morality is sometimes a component in the decision, in a holy war or crusade, for example, but even here, self-interest usually plays a role. Morality is often just a cover for the desire for more territory, more riches, more power. During World War II, the Soviet Union became a beloved ally of the United States, playing a key role in the defeat of Hitler. But after the war, it became America's darkest enemy. American self-interest, not the Soviets, had changed. Wars of self-interest usually end when the winner's interests are satisfied. Wars of morality are often longer and bloodier. If the enemy is seen as evil, as the infidel, it must be annihilated before the war can end. Wars of morality also churn up uncontrollable emotions. Luther's moral campaign against Rome generated such hatred that in the subsequent invasion of the Holy City by the troops of Charles V in 1527, German soldiers went on a 6-month rampage against the church and its officials, committing many atrocities in what came to be known as the Sack of Rome. As in war, so in life. When you are involved in a conflict with another person or group, there is something you are fighting over. Something each side wants. This could be money, power and position, on and on. Your interests are at stake, and there is no need to feel guilty about defending them. Such conflicts tend not to be too bloody. Most people are at least somewhat practical and see the point in preventing a war from going on too long. But those people who fight out of a moral sense can sometimes be the most dangerous. They may be hungry for power and are using morality as a cover. They may be motivated by some dark and hidden grievance, but in any case, they are after more than self-interest. Even if you beat them, or at least defend yourself against them successfully, discretion here may be the better part of valor. Avoid wars of morality if you can. They are not worth the time and dirty feelings they churn up. Reversal. The moral offensive has a built-in danger. If people can tell what you are doing, your righteous stance may disgust and alienate them. Unless you are facing a vicious enemy, it is best to use this strategy with a light touch and never seem shrill. Moral battles are for public consumption, and you must constantly gauge their effect, lowering or raising the heat accordingly. Here are further reflections on the righteous strategy. From The Mind of War, John Boyd and American Security, by Grant T. Hammond. Colonel John Boyd paid particular attention to the moral dimension and the effort to attack an adversary morally by showing the disjuncture between professed beliefs and deeds. The name of the game for a moral design for grand strategy is to use moral leverage to amplify one's spirit and strength, while exposing the flaws of competing adversary systems. In the process, one should influence the uncommitted, potential adversaries, and current adversaries so that they are drawn toward one's philosophy and are empathetic toward one's success. From Introduction to Strategy, by André Beaufre. The central feature of the exterior maneuver is to assure for oneself the maximum freedom of action, while at the same time paralyzing the enemy by a multitude of deterrent checks, somewhat as the Lilliputians tied up Gulliver. As with all operations designed to deter, action will of course be primarily psychological. Political, economic, diplomatic and military measures will all be combined toward the same end. The procedures employed to achieve this deterrent effect range from the most subtle to the most brutal. Appeal will be made to the legal formulae of national and international law. Play will be made with moral and humanitarian susceptibilities, and there will be attempts to prick the enemy's conscience by making him doubtful of the justice of his cause. By these methods, opposition from some section of the enemy's internal public opinion will be roused, and at the same time some sector of international public opinion will be whipped up. The result will be a real moral coalition, and attempts will be made to co-opt the more unsophisticated sympathizers by arguments based upon their own preconceived ideas. This climate of opinion will be exploited at the United Nations, for instance, or at other international gatherings. Primarily, however, it will be used as a threat to prevent the enemy undertaking some particular action. It is a point worth noting that just as in military operations one captures a position on the ground and thereby denies it to the enemy, on the psychological plane it is possible to take over abstract positions and equally deny them to the other side. The leaders of the Soviet Union, for instance, have turned into their own preserve the peace platform, that of the abolition of atomic weapons, while themselves continuing to develop them, and that of anti-colonialism, while themselves ruling